With support from Christie Clinic, with offices in Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, and Mahomet, providing quality health care to the residents of Central Illinois.
This is WILL Urbana. On December 19, 1996, WILL was granted a license by the Federal Communications Commission to serve the public interest as a public trustee until December 1, 2004. Our license will expire on December 1, 2004. We must file an application for license renewal with the FCC by August 1, 2004. When filed, a copy of this application will be available for public inspection during our regular business hours. It contains information concerning this station's performance during the last 8 years. Individuals who wish to advise the FCC of facts relating to our renewal application and to whether this station has operated in the public interest should file comments and petitions with the FCC by November 1, 2004. Further information concerning the FCC's broadcast license renewal process is available at the station, 300 North Goodwin in Urbana, or may be obtained from the Federal Communications Commission, Washington, D.C., 20554.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking with writer and wildlife photographer Seth Cantner, who was born and grew up in the wilderness of northern Alaska. We will be talking about his first novel, which was published earlier this spring, titled Ordinary Wolves, published by Milkweed. And it's a story of a boy and his family growing up in circumstances rather like those of Seth Cantner himself. It's about a boy who grows up in the wilderness, learning how to hunt and to be as self-sufficient as possible and learn with that environment. Someone who is a great admirer of the native people and yet not accepted by them. Then as the story progresses, he goes to the city and finds that he doesn't belong there either. It is a coming-of-age story that deals with competing values of both nature and consumer culture. And we'll talk about it here in this first part of the show. Seth Cantner is spending some time traveling around the Midwest talking about the book. In fact, this past weekend, he was here in Champaign-Urbana for signing at Pages for All Ages. And I believe this morning he's in Milwaukee. A little bit more about the writer. As I mentioned, he grew up in northern Alaska. He went to University of Alaska and University of Montana, where he received a bachelor's degree in journalism. He has had many different jobs. He's worked as a trapper, a fisherman, a mechanic, an igloo builder, and now lives with his wife and daughter in northwest Alaska. As we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Mr. Cantner, hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Yeah, sorry I missed you earlier in the month there. I was actually down in your territory.
Yeah, it's too bad that we couldn't have you here in the studio with us when we did that. But in any case, this is good. This is good. And maybe there are some of the people who got a chance to meet you or hear you when you were here will be listening. And, of course, anybody who has questions wants to call in, they can certainly do that. Well, in the book, when the book opens here, we're introduced to this the family, the Hawklight family, which is a dad and his three children, a girl and two boys. And the story revolves around the youngest of them and how they live their lives and so forth. Tell us, maybe just to start out with, give us a little bit of an introduction to this family.
Katuk is the Eskimo name of their Inupiaq name, however you want to say it. Of the Katuk Hawkley is the narrator, and he's 5 years old in the beginning. And I try to get him along to young adulthood fairly rapidly. He's enamored with Enoch Wolfglove, their most common visitor. They don't see people very often, but Enoch Wolfglove is an old Eskimo hunter who stops through on his dog team, and of course, Katuk wants to grow up and be like him. Mm.
His Eskimo name, as you explain in the book, means fall, not in the sense of autumn, but in the sense of falling on your face. And this doesn't seem to be a terribly auspicious kind of name to have.
Well, but I kind of take some of that out by the fact that it's accidentally misspelled it wasn't necessarily the name he wanted. He just got it, which is kind of how Inupiaq names work. Some people I know in the village, may name their kid Kumuk, which means head lice, and that's their Eskimo name, and nobody thinks anything about it. It's not like it's good or bad, or it is good. It's fine. This fits in with the way things are.
Yeah, well, he probably is glad to have it because it is an Eskimo name, and he feels this real strong identification with those people and the way that they lived, or perhaps the way that they used to live. And that's one of the tensions here, and is that the Nupiaq people there, they got no problem with modern technology. They don't seem not to want to live like their ancestors did, and they probably think that the way that Kutuk and his family are living in their sod igloo and by hunting and without a lot of modern technology, because that's what the dad wants. I'm sure that the native people think that there's something kind of wrong with those folks.
Well, yeah. they're building a skyscraper outside my motel room right now, so you may hear some pounding, but this is where I'm at. But there's parallels, you know, great parallels to my life here. I grew up in a sod igloo, and my dad was very impressed with the old Eskimo ways, and a large part of the native population was sort of turning towards the white ways, and to a certain extent. So there was a strange dichotomy there between West us, you know, family white people were doing it versus, you know, the nearby Eskimo village.
Mm. Well, why do you think it is that that Kutuk is so drawn to the that way of life, and this one man in particular?
Enoch Wolf Glove is sort of the epitome of the old ways, when you are a minority or you know, close to being an absolute minority, you know, just very few other people you're color around, you can get kind of go overboard in your enthusiasm to be like the others, you know,
yeah,
to be accepted.
Well, one of the things that's really striking is you get a picture of how this family, the Hockley family, lives, and about how much of the time they are alone or just with each other. That when a visitor comes, as is in the early part of the book, when Enoch comes for a visit, that's a big deal because there's so much of the time that they only see each other. And it's for somebody, you know, like me, I'm sure people who live around here, it's difficult to imagine what it would be like living in that kind of isolation.
Yeah, actually, I was joking the other night in Denver, I guess, that I feel like I'm lying now, going from city to city telling this little story. It's so surrounded by people, everything you do down here, that it's in the 10 days since I left the Arctic, I've kind of feel like my story has turned into a big old lie.
Well, is that the way that the Hockley family lives? That it sounds like that is, in, at least in part, based on your own experience and what it was like for you growing up.
Yeah, my characters are made up, my scenes are made up, but the arc of the story is autobiographical, and that's the way it was when I was growing up. Travel was much harder. Right about probably 1970 was the turn of the... from dog teams to snowmobiles, and that really changed the world there because snowmobiles travel high speed and can just whip across the planet like things do down here, you know, cars and planes. And the 30 years ago in the Arctic, things were much different, and that isolation was much more intense. But you can still find it if you go far enough.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting feature that this sort of controversy about, well, I don't know if controversy is the right word, but the dog sled versus the snowmobile. The family, the dad, is still living in the dog sled era. And at some point when Kutuk is a teenager, he has the money and he buys himself a snowmobile. And apparently most everybody else uses them. They're not into the old world living lifestyle of the dog sled. Is that a big, you know, when you set those two things next to each other, the dogs and the snowmobiles, and you think about the values associated with each one and what that means for how it is that you live, is that an important kind of dichotomy, almost a kind of a symbolic thing, balancing those two things next to each other?
It is. It's the dog team. Dog team has branched out too. Now you know there's dog racing is popular, and those people buy commercial dog food from Nabisco or whatever the brand name of dog food is. But they buy dog food and they race, and that's sort of a branch out of the old ways too. That's not like the old ways, and same with the snowmobile. But if you're living out with a dog team and trying to feed your dogs from the country, your whole life revolves around hunting and fishing to feed your family and your dogs, and that just sort of pulls you into the land instead of like a snow machine, which pulls you away from the land because you need money to buy parts, gas.
Yeah. Well, how many people live in a more traditional way anymore, or has mostly that been abandoned?
It's mostly been abandoned. There's still traditions, and there's still a huge emphasis on probably food from the land would be the quickest way of stating it. You know, gathering berries or gathering meat or fish or stuff like that. There's a huge emphasis on that, but almost all the things that accompany that are fading or have faded.
Mm-hmm. Well, how is it that your parents ended up in Alaska where you were born?
That story has a way of getting long, but my dad left Toledo to, I think, try to get as far away as he could from Central America or whatever you call this, Midwest, back east.
Central America is further south from me.
Yeah, and went to the University of Alaska, and in the process of going there, then sort of had a dog team and started being interested in some of that, and then he ended up going way up north and living in a little sod igloo with a woman and a man, and the man had one leg and they couldn't speak English, and so the woman was hunting and she taught him a lot of the old ways, and I guess he liked them, and you know went inland and built their own igloo, you know.
Mm-hmm. And growing up, when you were growing up, did you think that there was anything odd about living that way, or was it just that was what the world was, and you didn't really think about that?
I didn't think it was odd. You know, like I say in the book, travelers or company were you know, pretty nice to see people, and you know, if there was an idea that you know, maybe a family would move nearby and have kids or something, or you know, have young people to play with, anything like that was something we sure, you know, would have been excited about, but I didn't feel like, you know, we were, I didn't think it was that terrible until, you know, like I like to joke, you know, when high school came around, it became much less fun.
Yeah. Well, for you, when you went to college, was that a kind of a culture shock, or was it not that much of an adjustment?
Yeah, it was. It was. You know, I had, my grandparents were in Ohio, and we'd been there, but you know, you learn a tiny bit about the white culture, but you know, not enough. And yeah, college. I never really fit in that much, and I don't actually feel like I ever do anymore, any more than that, even now. So, college, I ended up dropping out quite a few times before I finished.
Mm. So, you found somebody to be your partner that pretty much felt the same way that you did.
Actually, my wife's from Boston, and she, we have, I guess, opposites attract. We're, you know, pretty different people. She grew up in Boston and has you know, a lot of understanding of, not the city is just a word I use, just, you know, people and little and small nuances of the culture that I don't understand, and then of course, you know, I have maybe some understandings of the country that aren't as obvious to her.
Mm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Seth Kantner. He is a writer. He is also wildlife photographer, and has done a lot of other things in his life. He was born and raised in the wilderness of northern Alaska, and he is the author of a novel. It's his first novel that's titled Ordinary Wolves, and it's published by Milkweed Editions, and has gotten a lot of positive attention. And he's now, right now, spending some time traveling around. He's in the Midwest. He's in Milwaukee, and as he explained, if you hear the pounding in the background there where he is, he's staying in a hotel, and I guess they're building a building next door to him, so that's just part of the joys of living in a city. We're talking here about his book. He was just here, in fact, this past weekend for a signing at Pages for All Ages. And if you're interested in calling in, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, you suggested maybe you could read a little bit, and I think that that would be, I'd like to give people the chance to, you know, have a feel for your writing and a little bit for the story. You can feel free to make the selection. I don't know what, if there's something in particular that you'd like to do.
I think it's really ironic here that there's this skyscraper being built as we talk, or sort of part of the conversation, but let me read just the first couple paragraphs of chapter one, just to set this up, and then maybe I'll read another paragraph further in.
Okay.
In the bad mouse year, 2 years after magazines claimed a white man hoofed on the moon, Enoch Wolfglove materialized one day in front of our house in the blowing snow and twilight of no sun winter. His dog team vanished and reappeared in the storm. Abe stood suddenly at the window like a bear catching a scent. "Travelers," he said. He squeezed out his half-smoked cigarette, flicked it to the workbench, wiped ashy fingers on his sealskin overpants. We kids eyed the cigarette's arc. We could smoke it later, behind the drifts, pretend we were artists like him. "Poke up the fire," he said. Abe grinned like an older brother, our best friend, no dad at all, "and hide the vanilla." His head and broad shoulders disappeared as he squirmed into his shedding caribou calfskin parka. He banged the door to break the caribou skin stripping loose and jumped into the storm. That's just the very beginning with the narrator, Cut, 5 years old, and Enoch arriving out front. And then I'd like to read, just if I can find a place here, of just Enoch talking a little.
Mm-hmm.
This is in the house, in the igloo there, an hour or two later. And Jerry is Cuttack's older brother. Jerry served boiled caribou pelvis in the cannibal pot and pilot crackers, salmon berries, koshimuk, and the margarine that travelers had left without the color added. Abe didn't allow something for nothing. Yellow dye was poison, the color of food was nothing. We all carried sharp sheath knives forged out of old chisels and files and used them to cut the fat and meat off the pelvis bone. Afterward, for a while, I forgot my shameful blue eyes and yellow hair when Enoch leaned back on the bearskin couch. He hooked his thumb under his chin. His gaze slid away beyond the leaning logs of the back wall. His pleasant face might have said, "Arigatou," but what he did say was, "That time it blowing, same like this, up Jesus Creek, kill my dogs." I wiped my greasy hands on my pants and climbed onto his words as if they were a long dog team to pull me away to the land of strength and adultness.
It's real clear, as we've talked, that Cuttack really idolizes this man, Enoch. Cuttack is clearly white. He's blonde and he has blue eyes, unlike apparently his brother and sister who have darker hair and might blend in just a little bit more. But for him, this is a problem. He's clearly not Eskimo. He doesn't look Eskimo. And as much as Enoch seems to like him, Cuttack gets a real rough time from the other kids.
Absolutely, yeah. That's just based on reality.
And was that also part of your experience growing up?
Yeah. It's I don't think things have changed too much, but I think, you know, we're cultures that the grinding point where two cultures are meeting is not always free of racism.
And also, he is Enoch. In addition to his troubles, he happens to be in love with I mean, Kodak happens to be in love with Enoch's granddaughter, who is a native girl, and that must also be a problem, too.
Actually, I found that to be hard to write, but interesting to me, and it's a pretty common thing. You know, the cultures are blending up there, and white people come up and they learn some Eskimo words and a few Eskimo ways, and it works in both directions.
Mm-hmm. What is it like that time of the year when it's dark?
My dad used to say it builds up in you. It gets worse with the years, and it's about 20 hours of darkness, about 4 hours of daylight, which is you could call twilight, I guess. You know, it's kind of a gray light. If you're outside running your dogs, it doesn't seem as bad. But if you're inside, or you could, if you have a job, you know, you could go to work and come home and just basically never see the light at all.
That, you know, knowing what we know about how, at least for some people, exposure to light or lack of it has a lot to do with your mood, I would be sure that living that way could literally make you crazy.
Well, yeah, I find that in the winter I can be very depressed in the middle of winter, and then summer kind of, I've heard the word, I don't know if it's true, but manic, you know, not sleeping as much and sort of camping a lot, hiking a lot, you know, just moving a lot, doing a lot of stuff. And, you know, right now up there, it's at night, it's just as bright as it is here in the day.
Yeah, so I suppose then that's the other side of the year, it's you get the opposite kind of thing because it's always going to be light then.
Yeah, it's actually more that the stereotypical version of 6 months of darkness and days. We don't get that. We're not living standing on the North Pole, but in the summer, about May 1st, it never gets dark again until mid-August. So we don't see our first star again for 3 or 4 months, and it's just the first stars and the first darkness kind of shake you up a little. You know, that's dark.
The family lives in this this sod house, and you use the word in the book, you use the word igloo, and I'm sure that for most people when they hear igloo, they think this of something made of snow. This is something a little bit different. But this also would be like the house that you lived in when you were a kid. What would that be like to live in?
You know, the snow igloo seemed to have captured people's imaginations, but basically the natives, the further north they went, the less they had to build from. So, you know, there's log cabins, I guess, and then further north there's it's warmer to be have your house built in the ground because it gets buried and the ground never gets cold. I mean, it's frozen, but the temperature of the ground is only like, you know, 20 above. Why, you know, if you're standing outside, it might be 40, 50 below. So your igloo is much cooler in the summer and much warmer in the winter than, you know, a plywood shack sticking up in the wind. But there's a lot of mice. It's damp. It can be damp. Stuff can mold in the corners. The traditional igloos were really small. And further north, you know, built with whale bones and drift logs, and then further north, you know, they didn't have that at all, and they had, that's when the blocks of snow came in.
In the story, as we talked a little bit about the fact that when the story is introduced, it's a dad and the three kids, and the mom earlier in the story has left. Apparently she decided that was not the way that she wanted to live, and so we have a single parent and the kids. And over the course of the story, as Katak grows up, his brother and sister also make their escape after a fashion. In fact, the brother goes to the big city. He doesn't come back. And his sister, Iris, she goes to college. She does come back. She becomes a teacher. She does come back, but she lives in the town. So she's also, in a way, made a break from the way that they grew up, not as much as Jerry, his older brother, who left completely, but the two, his two siblings, really do kind of make a break with the way that they grew up. And I'm sure you probably have known people that have gone both ways. Somebody who decided, who really wanted to live that way and and stayed with that, and other people who didn't, and who maybe if they had the opportunity, they left. What do you think makes the difference between wanting to stay and being okay with that kind of life and deciding that at the first opportunity you have to get out of there?
Well, I'm going to turn this around on you, David. And, you know, in Alaska, we got a lot of people from the Midwest. And I know my dad left when he was 17, and his family, by and large, brothers and sisters, stayed in the Toledo area and then spread out from there. And I think there's just there's people that stay and people that go. And I feel like, you know, I haven't stayed, you know, I'm living down, and then I start thinking about it. I'm living 200 miles downriver from where I grew up. I just kind of floated downriver a little ways. So I just think it's just people, just different interests, and, you know, they can be kind of confining, village life or staying in a region. The region where I grew up is, it's really like a small town. Everybody kind of knows you and knows everything about you, and that can be pretty confining in some ways.
Yeah. Well, maybe you're right. I mean, maybe that part of that is that's the difference between the life in a small town and the life in a bigger city, and that there are bigger city people and there are small town people, and maybe that's the thing. Because certainly around here, I'm sure that there are plenty of small towns where kids grow up and they just can't wait for the opportunity to leave.
Yeah. Yep.
Because they feel so constrained, because it seems so small, because you say the way it is with a small town is everybody knows everybody else's business, and there isn't the kind of privacy that you can have in a bigger city. And of course, some people don't, you know, they don't like that idea either. The idea that you could live in a huge apartment building and not know the people who live next door.
Oh yeah, it's a strange thing, you know, that driving through traffic and flipping somebody off. You wouldn't act that way crossing the village. I mean, it might happen, but it wouldn't be like you could disappear afterwards.
Yeah, I guess it may have something to do with the fact that people have to be able to rely on each other more, and you can't afford to alienate your neighbor, because one day you just might need that person to help you, and if you got them ticked off at you, you know, that then maybe that person would be less inclined to help you, and one day you might find yourself really needing it.
Yeah, and that fits in with my old life. You know, we were along a river, and there were travelers, and you know, an Eskimo hunter might show up and walk in and say, "I'm going to spend a night," it was just kind of understood that a person could stay as long as they wanted, any person, any time, and in a way, it was kind of neat, because you didn't have a chance to choose your friends as much as you do in a city, so you had to accept all different kinds of people. The fact that our house was, you know, just one room and very small, you know, I'm sure it was pretty hard on my mom when hunters would come and stay for a week. But there's a feeling when you're way out that you have to be extremely generous to everybody.
Yeah. Well, I think that also probably applies to a lot of other places, too, where people live in harsh and difficult conditions. When someone shows up at your door, you don't say no. That you just don't do that. You can't. And perhaps part of that has to do with the shared idea that, you know, sometime you might show up at somebody else's door. So we got to rely on the fact that we're all going to do that for the other, because you just have to.
Yeah, I wanted to back up on one of your questions and say that about the small town thing was that, you know, I might not stay in the Arctic if it was just the small town. So I can turn and face the other way, and it's a huge country. And that's what keeps me there, is that maybe the community is confining, but the country is the opposite. I find the country down here to be confining, because it all belongs to somebody, and there's fences and roads, and you can't just head across. You can't just go west or south or whatever. So the country provides the opposite of what, you know, the community might in that small townness.
Yeah. One sort of parallel, I guess I could imagine, is that one of the things about this country, that this part of the country that I think, you know, some people like and some people don't, is the flatness. But that also means that it has a really open feeling. And if you get to the right kind of place, you can stand there and you can look around you and have this feeling that you can look virtually to the edge of forever. And it makes you, maybe one of the things that it might do is make you feel kind of small. Well, I can imagine that being in the wilderness, it's something of the same kind of feeling. That is, you could be there, you could feel like you were basically alone, you could look to the, as far as you could look, to the edge of forever or wherever that was, there would be something really exciting about that, and also I could imagine something really frightening about that because you are so small.
I like that Urbana area when I went there because I did feel like my eyes could stretch out, and I think a lot of that just has to do with where you grow up, because you can grow up in wilderness. It's thick trees, interior Alaska, and you get used to your eyes are not used to stretching out. You're just kind of surrounded, but that's what you're comfortable with, and so I like that that Midwest feeling of just openness. Made me think of home, you know.
Yeah. Well, we're talking in this part of Focus 580 with Seth Kantner. He was born and grew up in the wilderness of northern Alaska. He's a writer, also has done some wildlife photography and some other things. His first novel is Ordinary Wolves, and it is published by Milkweed Editions and has gotten some good reviews. And he's now spending some time here in Central America to talk about the book, and he's in Milwaukee. He was just here in Champaign-Urbana this past weekend. So if you're interested in reading the book, you can certainly find it in the local bookstore here. Questions also would be welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, the book sort of has these two major sections, or maybe three major sections, and one concentrates on Katuk and what it was like for him to grow up. And then when he gets to be a teenager, he decides to go and find out what life in the city would be like, and he goes to Anchorage, where he lives in Fairbanks. Anyway, his brother lives in the city. He goes off and doesn't come back. And Katuk goes to Anchorage. And I don't know, is it possible that you could find something to read? Because you read something that said a little bit about what his experience was like growing up and what that would be like. Is there something that you might be able to read that would say something about what, when he goes to the city, what it is he sees and what that's like for him?
Yeah, I like that idea. I gotta look here and find something, but I haven't been reading that for some reason here as I travel around.
I know that's probably not the part that people are most interested in.
I think you're right. People want to hear the other part. Let me just start here anywhere. I don't think it really probably matters, but can't think with this pounding with them.
I know. I feel I'm feeling for you there.
I've had a couple in-studio interviews, and that silence, and it's pretty neat what you guys do. But sitting in a motel room while they're building the skyscrapers seems a little different.
Yeah.
I'm going to read page 185 here. He's in Anchorage, and he's just met Donna. Donna's from the village, and he was in love with her before, but he's just met up with her after quite a few years, and she's been living in the city, and she has a white boyfriend named Dave, and I think that's all anybody needs to know at this point. Page 185. Donna slammed their upstairs apartment door. She'd left lights on. On a four-drawer dresser, the TV stood. A green couch faced the TV. Dave pulled the switch. "I wanted to catch Letterman," he said. A blue truck door lay across cement blocks. The window was rolled down, clothes heaped and hanging through the opening. No books, college textbooks or otherwise, in the room. No meat saw, no skins. To the left was a kitchen, dark paneled walls, lined linoleum. Donna had never had time for kitchens. "I wanted to escape there, to wash her dishes. It wasn't even work, with water coming out hot and going somewhere by itself." David Letterman flung a book through a good glass window, the only book in the house. Both Daves laughed. There was a rabbity resemblance. Maybe they were cousins. White people had them, after all. The sofa was tired, the springs bony. A caribou skin would help and smell like home. The house made self-important noises, hums, drones, whirs. "You want pop?" Donna asked. She leaned into the fridge. The silver bars of empty racks gleamed. A 12-pack of 7-Up lay in there, a Ziploc of Punuktuk, a yellow squeezed bottle of mustard. I raised my eyebrows. She tossed a can. I scrambled after it. She grimaced. Adi, I forgot you always can't catch. The village rushed back, all the shame of not knowing how to play basketball or anything else that mattered, and having red hands doing it instead of brown. The clean, bubbly taste of 7-Up brought new memories, the jet ride with the beautiful flight attendant. My fingers played with the lock on the truck door while I kept my eyes off Donna's body.
So that, I think the nice thing about all of that is it just it sets up, I'm sure, in his mind, and it should in the reader's mind, if you've already read the section that tells you about how it was he grew up, all of these little things that we wouldn't think much of, the idea of turning on a tap and having water and having hot water, or the idea of having a box that makes cold to keep, to keep stuff in, that it just, it would, to us, this is so normal and ordinary we wouldn't think about it, but if you had grown up the way that he did, those things would seem so strange. You know, there, I think there's some point earlier in the book where someone asked him if he wanted a drink and if he wanted ice in it, and the idea that ice would come in these little squares, and that you would make that like that and then put it in a drink, that it seemed such a strange idea for him that he had to kind of think about it. I what are you talking about, ice cubes? So just, yeah, it's the idea that someone would have this box in their house to make cold. I'm sure that's a very strange notion.
And then pay somebody for it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and to pay for the pleasure to have the box to make the cold for you.
Yeah, I had a hard time writing the city part, and I wanted it to. I think it turned out pretty well, but I've been around all this stuff for so long now. You know, going to college, and then now I live in a house with all the, you know, running water and refrigerator and everything, and I wanted to remember how it was to be amazed by every little thing. And sometimes I'm kind of frustrated with the fact that, you know, people aren't amazed by tiny little things like doorknobs or carpet or anything that's, if you have to make it yourself, is just basically impossible.
Yeah. What I'm sure people find fascinating about this life that this boy leaves when he's growing up. And when I saw the material about you in the book, I thought, well, it might probably be pretty interesting to talk to this guy, because his life, the way that you live and the way that you grew up would be so different from me and everybody who would be listening that, you know, it would be a good opportunity to talk with somebody who's world was that much different. And, you know, I think the book does a good job of doing that. I think that's one of the things that I look for when I'm reading a book, is I'd like something that will take me to another place, some place that is completely different from the place where I am. And I think the book does a pretty good job of that.
Yeah, I've been surprised at, you know, I've gotten some surprisingly great reviews from people. And I was thinking maybe they were going to you know, not understand it or just be bored to tears by my book, and so I've been surprised at the reception to this story.
Let's talk about wolves, and particularly in not just in the context of the story, but in the context of that place. What wolves mean? What's the significance of the wolf?
Well, I'm still figuring that out. When I was growing up, you know, we did a certain amount of hunting, and it always seemed like my dad didn't want to shoot the wolves, and was pretty happy when they'd show up. I had a dog team, you know, and so the wolves occasionally would you'd look out on the river ice, and there'd be wolves out there, I guess, you know, just from hearing howling or smelling the dogs, and they were, you know, they passed through plenty often, and then the other side of the issue is that people in the village really value wolves as for the fur and the status of, you know, being a hunter that can get wolves, and so that kind of mixed in with my dad's view of wolves, where he really valued them for just being out there walking around doing what they do.
Yeah. Which is, I think, probably for, you know, if you live in this part of the country and you're interested in wolves, that's the thing that's going to grab you. That is the idea that they are just out there and living their lives. And I guess we associate with them, I don't know, the idea of freedom, independence, all kinds of human values and emotions. And I'm sure that if you have to live with them, you know, if you were a cattleman, you wouldn't feel fond of them. And if you were in a place where you were a subsistence hunter, you know, maybe you would just think that that was part of the landscape that you could use and you could do something with. And so, you know, I'm sure that you're, different people are going to have different relationship with the animal, and that's why probably when we think about wolves, it gets really complicated to decide.
Yeah, well, I think you pegged it pretty well. I mean, everybody's got a different version of what the wolf is, and I was always, you know, kind of tired of the fact that the wolf got so much credit or attention or stood for so much, and was a little bit distressed with myself for letting it into my book. But it's something about, you know, the way my dad treated him, and then another old guy up there that is sort of part of my Abe character surprised me. He's probably about 80 now, and all lives out in the tent, you know, most of the year, and a cabin the rest of the year. And he surprised me a year or two ago when he told me he'd never gotten a wolf. And you know, he's been a well-known hunter and subsistence, living off the land for 60 years or something, and to not have gotten a wolf says a lot, you know. And somehow that all got wrapped up in me and got wrapped up in my story, and then next thing I know, my book has wolves in the title even.
Yeah. Well, when you're talking about this man, you're talking about him, and it's not that he wasn't capable of shooting one, it's just he decided not to.
Yeah, the thing about him is, actually I wrote a story that I think is being published in Japan right now about him, and the thing about him is, you know, he was one of the most capable hunters in the whole, you know, Arctic maybe, and had chose not to get a wolf or ever get a polar bear too, I guess.
We have about 10 minutes left. I have a caller, and we'll get to them right away. Let me just introduce again our guest. We're talking with writer Seth Kantner, who was born and grew up in the wilderness of northern Alaska and has written a book that is partly autobiographical, at least when you learn some of the details of his growing up and those of his character, you can see how the two overlap. The title of the book is Ordinary Wolves, and it is published by Milkweed Editions. He's now spending some time traveling around talking about the book. He's in Milwaukee this morning. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I don't have anything on the book particularly, but just as a native Alaskan, I wanted to ask you about a couple of things. And one of them is the effect of the military in Alaska. There's a big base there. It's one of the messiest, I guess. That's a lot of army bases are being cleaned up now, but the one major one that I know about, it's also where Star Wars is based, so I assume there's a lot of money coming in that fashion. And I just wanted to ask you about this also seems that there's a cultural thing too. I think after World War II, many people mustered out into Alaska to look for oil and that sort of thing. So I wanted to know if those kind of impressions are accurate. And then it just stuck in my head that I hadn't heard anybody talk about this nuclear bomb that was was blown up underneath one of the islands of the Bering Straits, Chitka or something. I forget what it was called. I'm just I had this conversation on a call-in show some years ago about it, and it wasn't out of the question that they were looking at what it would do to the earthquake fault lines and whether they were trying to ease the problem. I met a fellow a long time ago who had gone to Alaska. He wasn't born there, but was there when the big quake in, what was it, 54, 56 hit? And your family must have been affected by that.
If I remember correctly, that was 64.
That late. Huh?
You've asked a bunch of questions.
Yeah, I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Yeah, let me back up here. There's a lot of bases in Alaska. Alaska is a big military state. The Dew Line, distant early warning sites, were up in, you know, the northern part. So there's one right outside of Kotzebue where I'm living now, and they tore that down and did a big cleanup. I think PCBs or something had been, I'm not sure what all had leaked or leached or whatever. And then the base you're talking about in the center of Alaska slipped my mind right now, but you're right, I think they dismantled that to a certain extent, and then they've been building that Star Wars stuff there, or whatever you call it. I don't know of a nuclear weapon set off in Alaska, but the reason my dad ended up in the Bering Straits region there was the military wanted to put off a bunch of thermonuclear weapons in the late 50s and early 60s to... Their reasoning was to make a harbor for the natives. Basically, they just wanted to put some bombs off, and of course the natives were using skin boats and didn't need a harbor that was a mile deep and glowing on the sides. That was, my dad had been up there studying radiation in lichens, and because caribou eat lichens, and Eskimo hunters and people, everybody eats caribou, and it gets concentrated. That's how he ended up there, and quit that job and lived in that couple in the igloo, and turned towards the older ways. So I don't know of a nuclear weapon put off in Alaska or a bomb set off there, but I know they had plans to do so.
So your dad was a biologist?
He was studying biology. He got a degree in zoology or something, and he ended up maybe like me, you know, lots of little jobs around the state, and he discovered what he says anyway fairly early on that in order to be really close to nature and experiencing it, you couldn't really be a biologist because then you had to go spend a you know, too much of your time in an office or doing paperwork, and so he turned towards more of the Eskimo way of relating to the land.
Yeah. A couple of the things that I have read about the book has referred to it as ecological fiction.
I saw that.
and claiming that it was a genre, and I, you know, maybe it is. I it's the first time I think I've ever heard anybody talk about ecological fiction. And I guess I wonder what you think about somebody putting that label on it. Whether you think that maybe that is, or maybe you're not even sure what that means.
Well, I'm a little nervous about it. I'd rather they just said it was a good story. I don't think it's necessarily bad, but it does seem like there's a lot of genres popping up now. I heard about some of these women's genres where it's about fashion. I can't even remember them all, but it's like dividing our literature up. And I imagine it'll you know, attract some readers and then maybe turn some off who, you know, don't want to hear about ecological fiction. They just want to read a story. I don't know. I guess, you know, it's out of my hands, so I'm.
Well, certainly it's the environment is, you know, this is a terrible cliche, but I'm sure people will say the environment, you know, it's like a character. Well, yeah, I guess it is. And this question of what your values are and nature and technology and all that certainly do enter into the book. But I guess I'm not quite sure what exactly that would mean, ecological fiction.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know that, you know, the land is really important to me, and you know, one of the things that I value most, and or maybe the most, and I wouldn't be comfortable writing a book that didn't, you know, talk about the land or try to, you know, help it somehow, as if, you know, we can.
Yeah. The other thing that I'm struck by is that some people make references, and it may just be because of the setting of the book, they make references to Jack London, and they somehow want to say that you're like, you know, connected somehow. And I don't know, do you feel a particular connection to Jack London?
No, that comes up constantly. I guess he's the epitome of, you know, Alaskan Arctic dog sled writing, you know, and it comes up constantly. I joke about it because when I was a kid, you know, I couldn't stand Jack London because some of his exaggerations, simply, you know, you spit and it freezes in the air before it hits the ground. just wasn't true. And so I was always kind of irritated by the fellow. But, you know, looking back now, I realize his descriptions of the cold and the trees and the Arctic light, you know, darkness, were very accurate. But he started off a century of exaggeration, and, you know, I'm hoping to start off a century of telling it like it is.
Yeah. Well, you have plans for writing some more?
Absolutely.
About the same kind of things?
Well, I'm going to write about the same, not the same characters, but the same people, you know, the same part of our state. I don't know anything else. You know, I can't write about Juneau or Milwaukee. I don't know about those things.
Well, you know, that's what they always say, write what you know. And I guess that you certainly are writing from your own experience, not only what your life is like now, but what your life was like when you were growing up.
I don't think you have to write what you know, but I think it's a good idea. I think too much of the world is somebody floats down the river where I live, and the next thing you know, they're writing about it, and they can describe some things, but they really don't they don't know what it's like there. They don't know what it's like in the winter, or you know what it's like to be a person who grew up there. And so you know, some things you can write about that you don't know, but I think it's pretty important to write what you know.
Yeah. So you think you have a daughter? She's six.
Yeah, she's six. Yeah.
So what do you think her future is going to be like? Do you think she's going to grow up wanting to stay there, or she's going to be one of those people that says, "I got to get out of here"?
Yeah, it would be hard to say, you know, because my wife teaches her a lot about books and computer and then you know, I take her upriver to the old igloo, and she's trying to feed the porcupine and help me skin caribou, and so she's. She's going to have to decide between two worlds, and hopefully she'll feel comfortable in both of them.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time. We appreciate it, and particularly with you putting up with the construction going on there in the background.
Well, I'll tell you what, David, when I hang up, I'm still going to have to put up with it.
Well, wish you all the best, and really appreciate you talking with us.
Yep, thank you very much.
Our guest, Seth Kantner. And again, if you'd like to read his books, the title is Ordinary Wolves, and the publisher is Milkweed Editions. He's spending some time traveling around talking about the book, and this morning he's in Milwaukee. The broadcast today is made possible in part by a grant from RE/MAX Realty Associates, currently handling over 30% of the real estate sales transactions in Champaign County. 352-5700. Nobody sells more real estate than RE/MAX, and they encourage you to join them in supporting public broadcasting. Programming is also made possible by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. Coming up in the next part of Focus 580, we'll have a healthcare topic for you. It's one of those things that we try to do basically once a year. And we have, throughout the year, we have generalists who are on the program, but then occasionally we have programs with specialists. And in the second hour today, we'll be talking about the care of the back. Just about everybody at some point experiences some back pain and can cause a lot of discomfort, can prevent you from living your life. But there are some basic things that you can do to keep your back healthy. We'll talk about that in the next part of the show with Dr. Jim Harms. He's an orthopedic surgeon from Carle Clinic. We'll have news at 1 minute past the hour. Right now, an update on the markets.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
A little bump in the wheat pit on an Egyptian buy. Corn consolidating above yesterday's losses, and